Jason found himself up on the stockade wall again, but facing easier odds than he had ever imagined. The boys on the north and east walls reported no action. Nothing at all. And so most of them, leaving a few sentries behind, had joined in the fight to the south. By 8 o'clock that morning, they had no one left to fight. But Jason was still worried. He supposed that the rest of the Apache force might have gone north with the intention of sacking the Morton place, though. And when a cry came that there was smoke on the northern horizon, he knew it for a fact. He only prayed that the livestock had been driven far enough away that the Apache wouldn't find them. And he didn't suppose they had, because next came the call that a cloud of dust was coming toward them from the north. Dust on the road to the Morton farm. He left a few men on the south wall. The Apache would likely circle them, he knew. But he wanted to get in the best possible volley when they reached the north side. He wanted to shock them into going away and never coming back, if possible. To tell the truth, it was beyond him why the Apache had picked this particular time to attack them anyway. They hadn't trespassed on Apache territory, the crops were too young to steal, they still didn't have much in the way of livestock. Except for cats, that is. The Milchers' mother cat, along with her get, had been on a kitten-making binge ever since they got to Fury, but he didn't think the Apache were fond of cats. Also, they weren't blocking the stream of water that he knew ran down through Apache territory, and they certainly weren't depleting the herds of pronghorn antelope the Apache relied upon to feed them. Oh, they shot one every once in a while, but so far they'd been able to survive on their own goats, hogs, sheep, cattle, ducks, and chickens. They prided themselves on being a self-sufficient lot. So what had gotten into these blasted Apaches? He'd be damned if he knew. All that was certain was that they'd better have a good reason for killing all these men in a battle. A battle that he fervently hoped they would never win. He stopped by his house to tell the Morton men what was going on, and that they'd probably lost their buildings, but Eliza haltingly informed him that their men had picked up their arms and were gone.
The rest of us can fight too, you know.
Well, I thank you, Eliza, and I'll keep it in mind. But for the time being, you can be the most help by staying inside and staying down, all right?
She nodded grudgingly, if a little to the right, and he hightailed it to the wall before she could let loose with anything else. Mayor Kendall was still standing, Jason noticed, as he climbed up the stockade ladder, and he had taken up a position about 30 feet down the wall. Saul Cohen was up and at him, too. Jason saw Ezra and Joel Evans down the way, and several of the wagon drivers from the convoy camped in the center of town, including Treat Paris and Jesse Figg and their leader, Fred Barlow. But they were far fewer in number than when they had started out, and Jason's hope for a good outcome began to shrink. They still couldn't see anything but dust coming from the north, but the cloud was getting bigger by the second.
Stop wasting ammunition!
And then a shot rang out from the oncoming Indian storm. He didn't know where they had picked up a firearm, but he hoped they knew even less about it than that shot indicated. Maybe yes, maybe no. But he saw the slugs sink into the ground with a puff of dust about 30 feet out from the trench. They were closer than he thought. He mentally counted to five.
Everybody, fire at will!
They still couldn't see any braves in the dust cloud, but by now the slugs from the town should reach into the approaching pack. If they were lucky, they could knock out at least half of them before they reached the wall. If they were lucky. And luck was on their side, for when the actual forms of the attackers could be seen through the dust, many of the horses were riderless. If they hadn't shot half, they'd at least made a good-sized dent in the attackers' number. The townsmen kept up firing, kept it up even while what was left of the war party split, some going toward the east, some dropping from their racing lathered ponies and taking up positions.
Now!
Every fourth man slid down the nearest ladder and headed for a new position. A third of them went to the east, the rest to the south. Jason stayed right where he was, and he took out three warriors by the time it took his men to cross the town square and mount the south wall.
Poor Apache didn't have a notion of what they were getting into.
Ward Wanamaker was still wobbly from Doc Morelli's powders, but nobody was going to keep him from fighting today. It seemed to him that there were surely a lot fewer Apache up there, and he wondered why the heck they didn't just give up and go home. Their numbers had been seriously depleted. He figured that it would be an awfully long time before they had Apache trouble again in Fury. He would have gone on home if he were in their shoes, or in their moccasins, if he wanted to put a really fine point on it. Which he supposed Milcher would. It occurred to him that he hadn't seen hide nor hair of the Reverend since the first day of the attack, and even then Milcher was running away, chewing his family before him like a frightened flock of goslings. Somebody ought to paint a big fat yellow stripe down his back, that's what. Didn't he believe in an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth? Some man of God he was. Ward finished reloading his six-shooter and slowly rose up again, carefully aiming his weapon at one particular brave who was sneaking too close. Why didn't they just give up? There couldn't be more than 20 or 25 graves attacking on the south. And why the hell hadn't one of the forts seen the smoke and sent their troops to come rushing in? No, he corrected himself. The forts were too far off to have seen any smoke, even that big black billow that went up from the oil. Fury was located on a boil on the backside of the Devil's Butt, that was for sure. And nobody was looking out for them but Jason. And maybe God. Although God wasn't doing an awful good job of it lately. He trained his sights on yet another brave, and downed him in no time. If nothing else, these Apache were surely brushing him up on his marksmanship, he thought. And then he missed one.
Dead, blasted!
This one hit home, and the brave fell forward, on his face. Dr. Morelli came up the ladder.
Anyone need me here?
Just keep down. We're doing all right for a bunch of sobbusters. How they doing up north?
Two casualties, but no one killed, as of yet.
I mean, how they doing engine-wise?
Jason says their ranks are much withered. He's expecting them to back off and go home at any moment.
Oh, me too. But if wishes was horses...
I know. Frustrating, isn't it? Take care of yourself, Ward.
That's why I'm using my Colt. Don't make my shoulder hurt me near so bad.
Good man.
I'm only good if and I live through this.
Jason signaled his men to hold their fire when he saw the Braves trying to move east and take their wounded with them. He hoped and prayed that this was the sign he'd been waiting for, that they were giving up and going home, finally. The men had passed along his order to hold their fire, and not a shot rang out as Jason circled the town.
Keep your places, men, just in case.
Although in truth, he had never seen a sorrier, more exhausted batch of men than those he crept around on his way to the south wall. Unless it was the Apache outside their walls, and he knew exactly how they felt. Megan McDonald struggled awake, although she felt she was swimming, not waking. She moved up, upward, toward some dim, dim light she more felt than saw. Upward, until the light took on body, took on color, took on shape, and then noise. And then, for no reason, clarity. Her neck hurt. She tried to raise her hand to it, but it wouldn't budge. She tried to speak, but her lips wouldn't move. She listened for the sounds of battle, but they too were absent. And then she felt her lips flutter.
Jenny. Jenny.
Back with us, I see.
What happened? Where am I?
It's all right. You're going to be fine. You're in our little makeshift hospital. You were shot in the neck, Megan. Don't worry, I got the arrowhead out and stitched you up. You're a very lucky girl. An eighth of an inch to the side and, well, all you have to show for your misadventure will be a tiny scar, I promise.
What?
Now, don't try to talk. Don't try to do anything but sleep. Your friend, Jenny, has been sitting up with you all night. I just forced her to go get herself some breakfast.
Megan blinked, long and slow. Morelli held a large spoon to her lips.
That's the girl. Now, take this. That's right. Just a little at a time. Good girl, Megan. Jason will be down to check on you in a bit. And yes, he's fine. The Apache have backed off for the time being. Ward Wanamaker thinks we've got them beat. Now, close your eyes, Megan, and rest.
Megan allowed herself to flutter her eyes closed, and just like that, she was asleep. When Jason reached the southern wall of the stockade, there was not an Apache in sight. The only thing remaining of them was a dejected dust cloud, trailing slowly off toward the southeast. He stood there staring at the retreating dust for what seemed like a long time, but was probably only a few minutes. They were saved. The Apache were going away at long last. Outside of a couple of razed ranches, and more than a few dead and wounded, the town had won. And then slowly, As if someone were letting all the air out of him, he sank to his knees, then his seat, and passed out. Saul Cohen was watching from across the way, and when he saw Jason begin the slow slide down to the planks upon which he'd been standing, he climbed down his ladder at the north wall and began to run across the square. The only thing he could think was that Jason had been shot, although he couldn't see any blood. But when he reached the other side of town and scrambled up the nearest ladder, Jason wasn't shot with an arrow. He was very simply unconscious. Things were never that simple for Saul, though. He raised Jason's head and slapped him across the face as hard as he could.
Ouch.
Are you all right?
Somebody just hit me, I think.
Come down off this scaffolding, boy. If you cave in again, you won't have so far to fall.
Wait a minute.
Waving him off, Jason hauled himself up to peek between the spikes at the top of the stockade again, as if he needed to remind himself. He'd been right. The Indians were in retreat. Even the bodies of their dead had been picked up and carried off.
Oh, they're gone. They're really gone. For good this time, I think, Saul.
May it please the Lord that you're right, Jason.
At the stable, Dr. Morelli found Jason a cot and took a good look at him.
Nothing but simple exhaustion. Although in this case, I think simple is too elementary a word.
What? There's something else wrong?
No. I just mean that this poor lad feels the weight of the world, at least our corner of it, on his shoulders. He's far too young to be saddled with such a heavy load.
So we should fire him after he has saved us all once again?
No, Saul, no. The load may be heavy on Jason, but face it, he's the only man in town with the patience and upbringing to be our sheriff. His father was a great man, and the sapling doesn't sprout far from the tree. Without Jason, we would have all died back in Indian territory at the hands of Quanah Parker.
Without my dice, too.
Yes, we can't forget your sugar cube dice.
The story of Saul's sugar cubes made into dice so that they could gamble with the Indians for the captive girls was fast turning into Cohen family legend. Saul was surprised and a little embarrassed that Morelli had heard his mutter. Apparently, someone outside his family had remembered the incident too, and also had excellent hearing.
Will he be all right?
Yes, I'm sure he will. He just needs a good rest, that's all, with nothing preying on his mind.
Thanks a good Lord.
Yes, indeed. And our brave townspeople, too.
Saul nodded. Well, some of them, he thought. Lone Wolf dropped out of the sad caravan of beaten Apache, leaving Clever Eyes to lead them the rest of the way home. Not him, though. He would not go back in shame. He would not dishonor his father and his wives and sons with his ineptitude. He would not hear his name mingled with laughter around the campfires, nor would he wish to hear it in sadness or anger each time a fallen brave was mentioned. And there were many to mention. Far too many. He was going back to the town that white men called Fury. He would find the one in charge, and he would fight him, hand to hand. He would be victorious and return to the home fires vindicated, or at the least, with some of his shame lifted. Moving on foot, Curly, Carlos, and Wilmer made their way from what was left of the McDonald Ranch and toward town. Carlos had drawn them all plenty of water from the well, so they didn't suffer from thirst, although they did suffer from the burden of carrying it. Wilmer had found several overlooked sheepskins hanging on the far fence, and he'd gone through them and found the three best, the three that he could make fairly watertight. He'd done a good job. Water dripped from all three hide bags, but at least none had let loose a gushing flood as yet. But they were heavy, especially when you were trying to walk almost 10 miles through the heat of an Arizona spring. But then, 10 miles might be just the start, Curly thought. When they got to Fury, there might not be any Fury left. All that smoke had to come from something, like a town burning to the ground. The Apache probably only stayed today to polish off the survivors. He wanted to weep, to throw himself down on the sand like a girl, and just cry and cry. But he didn't. He, along with the other two men, just kept on trudging and sweating and praying that he wouldn't find what he expected. At long last, the Reverend Melcher had allowed his family to climb up out of the Indian shelter he had dug under the altar. Up here, everything stank of burned wood and scorched fabric. But the sounds of the church were what interested him most. Not the sounds of the church itself so much, but the lack of sound from outside. It was still light, but there were no gunshots, no shouting, no sounds of arrows thudding into their hapless targets. There was only the sound of everyday activity. Without realizing it, the Reverend Melcher relaxed. They had survived, with God's help. He closed his eyes and gave thanks to his Father in heaven. There must be wounded that he could minister to, those injured who would take succor in the comforting word of the Lord. Gesturing to Lavinia to keep the children inside, he walked outside with the intention of going to Dr. Morelli's house. But he didn't have to go that far. On his way, he came across all the wounded in the livery. Someone had set up rows of makeshift cots, two or three to a stall, and end to end down the aisle, or at least what was left of the aisle. Fire had taken a toll on the livery, as it had on his house and church. Half the livery's roof was caved in, and the hay in the loft was gone, as was part of the interior of the stable itself. Someone had taken the initiative to clear it up, though. Rubble was pried out in the street, and animals were stabled in the best of the burned but intact stalls, with nothing but sky overhead for protection from the elements. He clutched his Bible near his heart and pushed back his shoulders. He must let these last few days pass from his mind. He was a man of God, and he would look the part.
Might I be of some help, Doctor?
I trust you mean more of a help than you've been these last few days.
Excuse me?
You've been conspicuously absent, Reverend. There are some here who would have welcomed a visit from you or your wife.
I'm sorry. I have been caring for my own family, seeing that no harm came to them, and constantly engaged in prayer for our population's deliverance.
And I'm sure that everybody's grateful, just as grateful as I am.
May I start at the far end and work my way up?
Whatever you want. Just don't wake up anybody who's asleep or dead.
Melcher wanted to make a subtly cutting remark, but Morelli had turned away and moved to the next patient. So instead, the Reverend walked to the far end of the livery and entered the last stall.
Good afternoon. May I share the word of our Lord with you?
The wagon train. They weren't far out of Fury now. In fact, Blake was certain they'd make it tomorrow. They hadn't seen any more smoke rising, but he thought he'd heard the faint sound of distant gunfire. It could just be his ears tricking him, he thought. Sadly, his hearing hadn't been the same since the war. His captain should have had to spend a few weeks standing next to that cannon, he thought. Then immediately reprimanded himself. War was a thankless job, and everyone had to serve where they were needed. Even if it meant they'd go partially deaf in one ear. It was a small price to pay considering what other men had given up. Their arms, their legs, their lives. To take his mind off his physical worries, he began to think about Fury and the townspeople that would likely greet them there. From Axel Baxter, the man he'd talked to about the little town, he'd learned that it had been named for the famous wagon master, Jedediah Fury, who had led them from Kansas City and later perished in the Indian Territory. Comanche, he thought the man had said. Such a shame. The man had been a true legend. But the wagon master's son had brought them the rest of the way and was now the town sheriff. That was nice. It was rather circular, actually. There were many shops there at which a small wagon train could restock if they planned to go on to California, and a doctor to see to your aches and pains if you had any. He'd like the doctor to have a look at little Seth, just because. Seth had been born without a doctor present. The baby showed no signs of anything wrong, but still, the Reverend Blake liked to stay on the safe side. He might ask the doctor to check out Laura, too. He wanted Olin to have his wagon checked over as well, and perhaps acquire a new spare axle. If it hadn't been for the first spare axle, well, Blake didn't like to think of the pickle they'd have found themselves in. He was thinking that maybe he and Laura and Seth would just stay on in Fury, but had no idea what the others planned, although he imagined they'd go on. He knew that Olin was set on California and the sea, and that Mankiller fellow was set on mining for gold or silver. Mining was good in Arizona, or so he'd been told. But for gold, Blake supposed the Mankillers would need to go to California, up toward Sutter's Mill, if it hadn't already been mined dry. He shrugged. His business was God, not gold. The day was clear and not overly hot. Wildflowers spread before them like an endless pink and yellow and lavender quilt, and things were going well. Why borrow trouble? Lone Wolf had stopped when the shadows grew long and made camp within a small stand of Palo Verde trees. He felt that he would sleep well that night, for he wished to be well rested for the coming battle with the chief of the whites. After he ate his supper, a hare he had killed along the right north, he had whetted his knife on the sharpening stone he carried, polishing it to a fine surgical edge. He would be victorious tomorrow, there could be no question of it. But to be on the safe side, he had offered up prayers, offered them in chanting and in smoke. He fell asleep and dreamed of slicing the white leader's throat, dreamed of the blood gushing out, and dreamed of his people at their fires, proud. Saul Cohen made his pallet on the floor alongside his boys. Rachel had fallen asleep hours ago, and he had played cards, go fish and old maid mainly, with the boys until one by one they had fallen asleep.
A fine thing this is, that a boy's last memory of his papa should be a game of old maid.
Now Jason had said that the Apache had folded their blankets and gone home, but then he'd said that before, and he'd been wrong before. Why should this time be any different? Of course, Jason had been right many more times than he had been wrong, but this little statistic slipped Saul's mind for the moment. All he wanted was his Rachel and his boys and a safe place to live, a nice place to live. This had been the nicest place he had lived in for a very long time, maybe ever. Only a few people in town despised them, Reverend Milcher and a few of his cronies, but no one had tried to set fire to their house, except the Apache, who hated everybody, it seemed, and no one had tried to run them out of town, or kill their livestock, or poison their well. If those blasted Indians would leave them alone, Saul was convinced that he and Rachel could live here forever and watch the town grow up around them. And he believed that had Rachel been awake, she would have agreed with him. Hadn't she already begun sorting out the dishes in silver to make a second kitchen in the house? Hadn't she already purchased a new boiler and baking sheets and set them aside? Was this something that a woman who was dreaming of moving on would do? Yes. His Rachel wanted to stay too. He smiled, before his thoughts returned to his friend Jason and those blasted Apache. He hoped that Jason was right. He hoped the Apache were gone for good and all. Curly, Carlos, and Wilmer had stopped about an hour back. They were only a little over a mile out of town, but Curly didn't believe he was up to looking at what was left of it this evening. It could wait until tomorrow. He stretched out on his blanket. The whole bloody mess could wait until tomorrow as far as he was concerned. He'd seen what horrible things an Apache could do to a white man, and he was not looking forward to seeing what had happened to the people in town. Next to him, Wilmer stood, wringing what would be his sleeping place with a rope.
What are you doing, Wilmer?
You know what I'm doing. I'm keeping rattlesnakes from climbing into my bedroll with me.
Now, Curly had heard this old wives' tale more times than he could count, about how the rattler thought it was another snake that he was trying to climb over and took off for fear of being bitten. Curly had to admit he'd seen it work, once, and that rattler must have been dumber than a post if he thought that prickly old chunk of dead hemp was another snake. Besides, they climbed over each other all the time, didn't they? But he didn't want to get started with Wilmer, or with Carlos, who'd already ringed his pallet and was fast asleep.
Ain't you afeard of snakes?
What?
I said, ain't you afeard of snakes? Now I got enough rope to do us both.
Fine, Wilmer. That'd be right nice of you.
Jason slept through the night, and when he woke with the dawn, he actually felt good. He checked on a still-sleeping Megan and found her doing well, or at least Jenny and Doc Morelli said so. She looked to be of better color than the day before, though, and he was encouraged. When he walked out of the livery and onto the town square, Saul Cohen, already awake and on the wall, informed him that there were no Apache in sight. Next, he went back in the livery to check on Ward, who was snoring like mad. Rather than disturb him, Jason hied himself over to the house. He didn't enter, but went directly to the stable, where he grained his mare and Jenny's and their father's old roan horse and fed the chickens, then turned the horses out into the corral with the Morton's draft stock and mucked out the stalls. The garden needed a good watering, but he put that off until later. Next, he had to go turn his prisoner loose. When he got to the jail, he found Matt McDonald up and awake and talking to one of his hands, Curly Lohan, through the bars of his cell.
Everything?
Morning, gents. And congratulations to you.
What?
For making it back to town. When we saw your smoke, we figured you were as good as dead. Other boys make it out okay, too?
Yeah, they did. We was pretty surprised to find the town still here, too. Seen the smoke, thought you was goners. Glad to see we was wrong.
Thanks, Curly. We're pretty happy about it, too. Time to let this monkey out.
I'll monkey you, Mr. Tin Badge.
Best hold those comments for folks with lesser hearing, McDonald. How'd you get out of being burned, Curly?
We stayed down in those hidey holes, Mr. McDonald. That Gil, what's his name, feller, had dug under the bunkhouse when he was working for the spread, and they was putting up the buildings, the house, too.
Gil Collins, you mean?
Yes, sir, that's him.
Fella keeps getting himself almost killed.
Huh?
Ask your boss.
It had been because of Matt that Gil had got himself stove up the first time 2 years back. Even Morelli had taken a look at him and pronounced him dead. That is, until he sat up in his coffin the next afternoon and asked for water, beefsteak, and the doctor, in that order. This time it had been because he hadn't seen the Indian on the gate. But he was getting better, too. Jason had checked. He was beginning to think of him as Gil O'Collins, seeing as how he seemed to have the luck of the Irish.
Would you move your damn feet, Curly?
Ow!
Curly jumped back, and the cell door hit him in the face.
You best go over to the livery and see Doc Morelli.
Stop telling my man what to do. Now where's your sister, Fury?
Believe she's across the way, at the livery. Seeing to your sister.
What's wrong with Megan?
Took an arrow in the neck.
What? How?
Don't worry, she's all right. She's got the best care in the world. Jenny was with her when it happened and got her to Morelli right away. Go on, Matt. Get the hell out of here.
Matt slammed the door behind him, leaving Curly in the office, blinking.
You can go too, Curly.
Thanks.
Curly left too, although Jason noted that he headed for Raleigh Bigston's place.
Attaboy, Curly.
Ward Wanamaker was awake and ambulatory, and had joined Saul Cohen up on the stockade, sitting down next to him.
Getting used to the place? I reckon you could bring some chintz up and make the place real homey if you was of a mind to.
Did Dr. Morelli kick you out?
Nah, it was the Reverend. Couldn't stand it anymore.
Milcher?
Only got but the one, last I heard.
Sad but true, my friend. How is Miss Megan doing?
Pretty fair, I think. Jenny's still sitting with her.
She has a good heart, that one.
Yeah, she sure enough does. You take a look out there lately?
No.
Ward levered himself up carefully, watching both the stockade wall and the lip of the boards he was standing on. When he rose up to his full height, he looked out through the spikes at the top. He stared for a very long time, not moving.
Ward? Ward, what is it?
Come up here, Saul.
Saul gingerly stood up and peeked through the spikes. There, down below them, and about 40 feet out from the stockade wall, was a lone Apache warrior in full war paint, singing his death song, a thing that Saul, now that he had no more stockade logs blocking it, could hear clearly. And he was frightened.
I'd best go get Jason.
Wait. Start over.
You heard me the first time. He wants the leader of the Whites to come fight him, and he's serious. He's singing his death song, in case you want to know just how serious he is.
Alone?
Yes, goddammit.
What weapons?
Knives.
Oh, crud.
Don't worry, I set the freighter smithy to whetting you the finest blade he could lay his hands on.
That's comforting. When's this supposed to happen?
Whenever you show up, I guess. Though he did say something about high noon.
Good. I like noontime. Sun doesn't get in your eyes unless you look straight up. Just burns the living crud out of you.
Could be worse. Could be July.
Hey, now, hey.
The two men walked purposefully across the square, behind the livery, and up the nearest ladder. Jason could hear the death song now. He listened for a moment.
What's he saying?
More death song.
This fight he wants to have. Is it supposed to be to the death then? Or is he doing it just to scare us?
He's an Apache. Is there any other kind than the first?
Figures.
He ain't got no more braves with him. Only thing he brought was that red and white pony tied out to the left back behind those prickly pears.
What happens if he wins?
He goes home and they have a big party. And he probably saves a little face.
Then he comes back to polish off the rest of us?
I reckon so.
And if I win?
Then I don't reckon he goes home at all.
Retribution?
Couldn't say.
I'll go in your place, Jason. They don't know your face.
I appreciate it, Saul, but no. You have a wife and children who need you, and who'd never forgive me if I got you killed on my account. But there is something you can do.
Anything?
Well, I want Ward to come along and translate.
Sure thing.
And I need you to stay up here. If the Apache takes me down, I want you to kill him before he can make it to that pony and ride back to his people.
But what if I...
If you have to pretend that he's going to turn any moment and shoot at you, then pretend.
Yes, Jason, I'll do it.
No, you would, buddy. Come on, Ward, I've got our best man to back me up.
But God dang it, Jason, why you got to go fight him anyway? It ain't like the whole Apache Nation's out there watching and gonna give you a turkey if and you win, and then promise to leave you on your own for the rest of your natural life.
I know that, Ward.
But Jason... Oh, cripes, I just don't get you at all sometimes.
That's all right, Ward. And I don't get me either.
Jason found Jenny, who reacted slightly more violently than had Ward.
Damn you, Jason! Damn you! Why? Why? You've got to be six kinds of a fool! Why don't you just go back up there and shoot him? They attacked us, not the other way around! They don't have any sense of fairness or decency. Why should you show them any at all?
Somebody's got to do the right thing, Jenny.
But why is it always us? Why is it always you?
It's coming on noon.
I know.
They'd made the rounds and told everybody of importance what Jason planned to do and to hold their fire. They were back around to the south gate again. They had collected quite a group of followers on their way around the town, and Mayor Kendall was right up front.
You ready?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Jason unstrapped his six gun and hung it on a post.
It better be there when I get back.
Kendall slid it off the post and onto his arm.
I'll hold on to it for you, Jason.
And Ward's, too.
Jason motioned to Ward to take off his gun, too. Ward hesitated a little too long. It was against his religion to go anywhere near a wild Indian without a weapon at his side, if not in hand. But at last he stripped himself of his gun belt. Mayor Kendall accepted his rig, too. And Ward figured that the next time they had an election, here or any place else, he was going to run for mayor, not deputy. And he was definitely not going to toss his hat into the ring for sheriff. Jason took the big Arkansas toothpick from the man who'd wetted it and gently ran it over his arm. It left behind a thin red line that dripped blood.
Nice.
We aim to please. Best of luck to you, Sheriff.
Jason nodded, while Ward and the others chimed in with their felicitations as well, although Ward noticed that nobody wished him luck. Nobody ever wished the deputy luck. Somebody opened the gate's latch, and it swung in toward them.
All right, Ward, let's do it.
Jason stepped into the opening and out the gate, and into the stark rays of the noontime sun. Against his better judgment, Ward followed along behind.
Close it up, man.
Ward felt a distinct whistle of cowardly wind flicker over his backside as the gate slammed closed and the latch went back down. The Apache, who had been sitting on the ground and silent when they first stepped out, rose to his feet. He was tall for an Apache. Ward guessed him at about 6 feet. And he was as lean and muscular as Jason was. Maybe leaner and more muscular. Great. Ward found himself wishing that he'd kept that little pocket gun he'd taken off Raleigh Bigston last year. He had a feeling it would come in awful handy in a minute or two.
Tell him who we are and ask him what he wants.
Like we don't know.
Speaking in Apache, Ward told the warrior that the man next to him was Jason Fury, the high sheriff of their city, and added that he himself was just an interpreter. He explained that Jason came armed with only one blade, as requested, and would fight him now, but only if his opponent gave his name. Ward translated what he'd said for Jason, then listened while the Indian spoke. He translated this, too.
He said, "I am called Lone Wolf. I carry one blade, as I have told you, and nothing more."
"You ask him if I win this fight. Are his people gonna leave us alone?"
Ward jabbered, then the Apache jabbered.
"Yep."
"That took you long enough. Sure you didn't recite the Gettysburg Address in there somewhere?"
"Huh?"
"Well, how long are they gonna leave us alone for?"
"Didn't say."
"But..."
"I wouldn't press him on it, Jason."
"Well, I suppose we'd best get to fighting."
Ward repeated Jason's comments to Lone Wolf, except for the aw crud part, and Lone Wolf replied to him at length.
"He says to take your shirt off."
"Why?"
"Well, you're lucky he didn't tell you to strip out of them pants, too."
Reluctantly, Jason shucked out of the sleeves of his flannel shirt, then tossed it over to Ward. He stood up a little straighter, the knife in his right hand, its blade pointed up and out.
"Just as well. Keep it from getting all full of holes like the last one. Tell him, come on, let's go."
The wagon train. Olin Whaler nearly ran his rig into the back of Blake's, for Blake had called a halt, and Laura, startled, had reined their team in very suddenly. Olin jumped down from the seat and stormed forward.
"What's wrong with you, man? Somebody could have been killed! Now we're almost to Fury!"
He pointed toward the town in the distance. Actually, it looked more like a small fort, being lined all around with a tall stockade fence. Blake got down off his horse and unslung the binoculars from around his neck. He handed them to Olin.
"Take a look."
Olin held them up to his eyes. There were the stockade walls of the town, which he could now see were chopped into points at the top. There was a dark spot at the base of the wall nearest him, as if it had been set afire, then put out before much damage could occur.
"Then what am I supposed to be seeing?"
"Look to the south."
Olin did, and made out a few figures. With a little adjusting of the lenses, he discovered two white men facing an Indian. One of the white men was standing well back from the other two men, and what Olin could see of the lip of the southern wall of the town was lined with men, like spectators at a prize fight.
"What the hell?"
"Exactly. I think we need to wait and see what happens before we go trotting in there big as life, don't you?"
Slowly, Olin nodded. The white man was wounded, Lone Wolf noted as he walked nearer. His shoulder was bandaged. Good. A weak point right from the start. This would be his day. This would be an Apache day. He would gut this pale one with no trouble. Jason marched toward the brave slowly, but as he moved nearer, he decided he had several things in his favor. First, Apaches usually didn't sharpen their blades on both sides. His was, and both sides were like razors. No matter how he struck the man, his blade would slice. Second, he'd had training, thanks to the U.S. Army, in hand-to-hand fighting. All right, that didn't count for much when it came to outwitting an Apache, but he'd been involved in a skirmish or two since coming west, and he thought he could figure out the brave's moves. He hoped he could, that is. And lastly, he had Saul up on the stockade. If he was killed, a thing he was fervently trusting wouldn't happen, then Saul would blast the brave, so at least he couldn't go home and brag about his victory to the other war chiefs. One way or other, Jason figured that the town of Fury was saved, and that had been the goal all along, hadn't it? Well, that, and to keep on living, and to marry Megan McDonald, and to see somebody nice matched up with his sister Jenny, and... He stopped walking. The brave stopped too, a few feet from him. The brave said something Jason didn't understand.
"Same to you, friend."
The brave tossed his knife from hand to hand. Jason did not. He was afraid he'd drop it. He simply scowled and took a wider stance. The brave leapt toward him, blade first. Jason leapt to the side. He felt the knife meet something, but could tell it hadn't gone deep. Jason landed on his feet, just in time to brace for a second attack. This time, Jason jumped back while nicking a narrow slice down the brave's heavily muscled back. Jason glimpsed a thin, bloody length of skin limply flapping. The brave had yet to touch him, let alone wound him. Don't get cocky, he told himself. But it came too late. This time, Jason felt the knife rip at his bandage, felt a new gush of blood. He didn't know whether the old wound had just opened up, or the Apache had created a new one. The two men, each maddened by impatience, began to wildly attack each other. No planning, no thought, no rules. They fought like wild animals, desperate creatures. And less than half the time when Jason lashed out, did he meet more than air. The Apache wasn't having any more luck striking Jason's body. Although Jason felt the knife slice into his arm, across his belly, and skitter along his ribs, the misses by the Brave far outnumbered the hits, and all Jason's wounds were shallow. More times than not, Jason was able to block a thrust before the Apache's blade could penetrate flesh. It was just that they were both moving so fast, so desperately. And at last, Jason actually began to think. This time it was he who snatched the second it took to form a shaky plan. Lone Wolf froze in shock. With Jason's knife embedded in his chest, Lone Wolf did the only thing he could. He thrust his knife hard into his opponent's shoulder. He hoped he had found the joint. With his last strength, Lone Wolf twisted his blade. Jason threw everything he had into his knife hand, forcing it up and just slightly to the side. That was all it took. Blood gushed over Jason's knife hand, and Lone Wolf went limp in his arms. Jason let him slide to the ground. And when he backed away from the crumpled corpse, he sat down, hard, and fell back in a dead faint. And his last thought before he passed out and dropped into a deep well of soft, welcoming black was pleasure that Saul now wouldn't have to shoot somebody that wasn't shooting back at him. Blake, wearing the collar he had put on at Laura's insistence, sat on his horse ramrod straight outside the stockade walls.
Hello, the gate! Hello, somebody!
Open the gate, somebody! Visitors!
Blake was greatly relieved. There was someone in there alive after all. Then the gate swung open, and the four wagons of his little train passed through the gate while Blake stayed outside, watching over them. When they were safely inside, he rode in after them, and the gate was closed behind him. A man came up to him and grabbed his horse's reins. But the man seemed friendly, at least he was smiling, so Blake took no offense.
Howdy. I'm Ward Wanamaker, the town's deputy sheriff. Glad to see you folks. Glad you came when you did. If you'd come a day earlier, you would have likely ended up dead. We've been having some Indian trouble, which is why the town's locked up tighter than a tick.
I see. We thought we saw smoke a couple of days past. Was that part of your trouble?
Yep, sure was. Long story, which I'd be glad to tell you over a beer. That is, if it ain't against your religion, Reverend.
Not at all. I'd like to get my people settled first, but yes, that sounds wonderful. Where should I meet?
Right here at Bigston's. But I'll come along and get you settled in. Afraid you'll have to stay in your wagons for the time being. We're fresh out of any place to put you up.
As he rode after the wagons and the deputy strolled at his side, Blake looked around at the town, saw the burned-out buildings, and also saw the people, joyous at their deliverance. He made up his mind. This was the place they'd stay and put down roots. This was home. Jason lay at the bottom of what seemed like a deep, black, but amazingly comfortable well.
Jason?
Oh, Jason. Please wake up.
He occasionally had a notion that there were people around him, and he even seemed to be the topic of their conversation. But curiously enough, he didn't seem to be able to do anything about it.
Now I've told you, folks, it's sheer exhaustion more than any wound. If you'll all back off and let him sleep, he'll be right as rain when he wakes up. Aside from that shoulder wound, that is.
Well, exactly how long do you feel this might take, Morelli?
That's enough. Come on, all of you, out.
Out, Jason thought. What a nice idea. And he dove a little deeper into that comfortable well. Megan was getting better each day, but not enough that Morelli would let her get up from her cot as yet. Jenny sat beside her, going on and on about Jason and what he had done for the town and what a wonderful brother he was and so on and so forth. And Megan could listen as long as Jenny wanted to go on. As angry as she'd been with Jason on the day she rode into town, how long ago had that been? She was filled with love for him now. Love for him because he'd arrested her brother rather than let him ride, hell-bent for leather and full of pride, straight into a swarm of Apache. Because Jenny was going to stay here with him in town, and she loved Jenny almost as much as she loved Jason. And because he'd done the impossible. He'd saved the town of Fury, lock, stock, and barrel. Saved it and them all once again. Now, these were but a few of the things Jenny had told her while she lay here, unable to reply or even open her eyes. She'd heard Curly come through, too, with the news that their house was burned to the ground and all the outbuildings, too, but that he and Carlos and Wilmer were all right, though the blasted Apache had made off with their horses. She was sorry for their captured mounts, who were likely being whipped silly, if not served up for dinner by their new owners, but otherwise overjoyed for the Three Hands' good fortune. She hoped that her wound wouldn't be hideous when it healed. She hoped it wouldn't show at all. She couldn't imagine Jason paired with anyone less than perfect, not even her. She pictured him in her mind, his blonde hair bleached almost white by the Arizona sun, his once pale skin bronzed by the same culprit, and those pale blue mesmerizing eyes, those eyes you could fall into, and fall, and fall, and fall.
Doctor! Oh, Dr. Morelli, come quick! Megan smiled.
The newcomers had been settled in, and now Ward Wanamaker strolled down to Jason's house, feeling as full of himself as if it had been he who had killed that Apache brave with his own two hands. He rapped at the door. It felt funny to knock since he lived here most of the time, but in a few seconds, Susanna Morton answered the door. Immediately, she smiled and asked him in. Over tea, he brought them up to date on the current situation. Susanna and her sister-in-law Eliza oohed and aahed in all the right places, and Miss Electa and Miss Europa softly oh-my'd or gasped when they weren't pouring tea or offering him more of the funny little sandwiches that Susanna had made. When he finished everything he could think of to tell them, Miss Europa, whom he had never thought of as Mrs. Griggs, although he should have, asked when they might go home, seeing as how the Indians had gone south and, according to him, were not expected back. It left him in a bit of a muddle, since only the sheriff could give them permission, and the sheriff, Jason, was unconscious at the moment. They'd been bravely defended from the Apache menace by Ward himself, of course, but he told them they'd have to wait for Jason, and that was all there was to it. All four women nodded in agreement, but on his way out the front door, Miss Electa pulled him aside.
Deputy Wanamaker, thank you for taking the time from your busy schedule to keep us apprised of the town's matters. We are most sincerely grateful.
She gave his arm a soft squeeze on the word most. Well, Ward couldn't make it back to the office fast enough. This was all wrong. Jenny was the one he wanted, even though she was married to somebody else. He didn't want wizened Electa Morton. Why, she was old. Probably as old as he was, for cripe's sake, and talked like a Kansas City banker to boot. Just the thought of it shook him so badly that when he got back to the office, he drank half of the bottle of whiskey that he'd hidden in the bottom drawer of the file cabinet. The wagons around the well in the center of town showed no signs of moving on, and not because their owners had been told to stay. The people were simply exhausted and hungry. Olympia Morelli had the cook fires going again, and was brewing up a kettle of stew the size of which was reported to be someplace between two nail kegs stood end to end and the size of a grand piano sound box. As usual, it was a good thick stew, full of big chunks of beef and potatoes, with beans and corn and tomatoes and onions, and sided by Olympia's own excellent biscuits with sweet cream butter and wild mesquite honey. Or fruit preserves for those with more exotic tastes. All the men in town were either drunk or stuffing themselves with Olympia's bounty, or both. The newcomers joined in the feast, too, and were more than happy to taste Olympia's cooking. One of the ladies was overheard to say that it was the best stew she'd ever tasted, aside from her own, of course. Almost all of the womenfolk were keeping themselves busy cleaning. After all, they'd had smoke or dust blown into their homes for days, or tracked in by bleeding husbands or sons, and most of the time they hadn't been allowed to do anything about it. They'd stayed inside, hiding with the children as they'd been told to. But even they got a bite or two of Olympia stew. Even Raleigh Bigston, drunk as a skunk, waddled up the street to Olympia's outdoor kitchen.
Stew!
Jenny, who was manning the kettle while Olympia made the rounds of the shut-ins, grabbed a bowl, ladled in two dippers of the rich concoction, stuck a spoon in it, and handed it to Raleigh.
Stew to you, too.
Thank you.
A few minutes later, Abigail Crimp came walking up with a disgusted look on her face.
Ugh, don't give Raleigh nothing else to eat. He'll just throw it up again.
Outside?
No such luck.
Sorry, Abigail.
Oh, no need. Raleigh's gonna be sorry enough for himself and everybody else, too. I'm gonna let him lay in his own mess till he wakes up. Have you got a spare bowl for me? I found a nice place to eat. Outside.
Jenny fixed her right up, and Abigail walked away.
Bang, bang, bang! Bang, bang! Hey, I got you!
No!
When Saul went home to check on Rachel and the boys, he found the children racing around the hardware store playing cowboys and wild Indians, and Rachel up, fully dressed, and opening the register for the day.
Rachel, are you feeling well enough already?
And shouldn't I be the judge of that? I'm feeling fresh as a daisy, thank you, Saul. Don't you think you should turn the sign on the door around?
Certainly, certainly.
Saul flipped the closed sign around to open.
And?
And what, my dearest?
And what has brought on this rapid recovery? This morning you were...
Not well, I know. But Dr. Morelli brought me the excellent news, and I suddenly felt so much better.
The excellent news?
About Jason and the Apache. And you, my brave, brave Saul. Jason has the whole town to pick from, and it's my Saul he chooses to watch his beck. I ask you, could I be more proud?
As long as I live, Rachel, I will never understand women.
And what would you do without a Saul?
Live long, prosperous, worry-free lives, I'm guessing.
Oh, Saul, you'd be unwashed, poorly fed, and very badly tempered.
True, as usual.
Of course.
Colorado Gooding, well enough to be on his feet with the aid of a single crutch, stepped out of the livery into the fresh air.
Better.
He hadn't minded the stink of animals nearly so much as the stench of scorched wood. And the smell of the fellow next to him, gangrene if he was any judge, hadn't been a real picnic either. He looked around himself on the street, looked at the wagons and the stove-up men, and the town's kids just beginning to wander out into the street. Matt McDonald was getting his buggy hitched up in front of the bank. Was he leaving without his missus? Colorado had passed Jenny on his way out of the stable, and Miss Megan, too. Matt's sister looked to be banged up pretty bad, and it seemed funny that Matt hadn't beaten a path in there right away, just to make certain she was still breathing. But then again, he reminded himself, you never could count on Matt to do what was expected. Unless, of course, it was puff up and carry on like a half-grown rooster, and then turn tail and run. He couldn't spy Jason anywhere, but he spotted Mayor Kendall up the way a bit, and Randall Nordstrom. Rachel and Saul Cohen looked to be opening up their hardware store, and Carrie Kendall was polishing the glass in the Kendall's front window. Both Rachel and Carrie were right pretty women, he thought, and nice, too. Wash Keogh, who up until this very moment, Colorado had figured was off somewhere happily digging for gold, lay on a cot outside, in the shade of the boardwalk overhang. His leg must be all busted up. At least there was a splint bandage tied to it, and one of those fancy plaster casts on his foot and ankle. Wash waved at Colorado, and he ambled on down with a big grin on his face.
Glad to see you're still breathing.
You and me both. Appears to me we've been saved again.
How'd that happen, anyways?
Wash told him as much as he knew anyhow, or could remember.
I'll be damned.
Got that right.
Neither man had planned on settling anywhere near here, but it seemed they'd both sunk in their toes and were going to live out their last days amid the folks of Fury. Which was a very good thing for the town, Jason had once told Colorado. Colorado had nodded sagely, though he hadn't had the slightest idea what Jason had been talking about. Maybe he knew now, though. Maybe Jason had been talking about their collective need for cannon fodder. That was one thing Colorado had learned over the years, that if he was good for anything, it was as a moving target. And he said so to Wash.
Me too, I reckon. At least we know we're appreciated, Colorado. That's more than I've had in half the places I hung my hat before.
Where's Jason?
Over in the jail. Locked in and doped to the gills.
Locked in?
Locked in for his own good. So his folks leave him alone for a while.
Cunning Dog was twisted on his pony, scanning the northern horizon for any signs of his brother's return. There were none. Traveling next to him was a young brave called Mole Eyes.
But he is a good fighter. He should be back by now.
I warned Lone Wolf not to travel back to the town, but he wished it so. It is an evil place full of white devils. Only in the most evil of places could we lose so many brave men. There will be mourning in the camp when we reach it.
You tell me nothing new. I say someone should go back for Lone Wolf. Maybe we should all go back and teach those white devils whose land they have made their town on.
You are justly named. You are indeed blind. No one will go back. No one will save Lone Wolf except himself. It is how he wishes it to be.
You are a coward, Cunning Dog.
Never say that to me again or I will kill you. Do you understand?
Too frightened to speak, Mole Eyes jerked his head up and down. Cunning Dog stared at the young warrior a moment longer with a sneer of disgust. Then he trotted on to take his place among the others, leaving Mole Eyes behind. Blake sat on the tailgate of his wagon next to his wife and infant son, watching the sunset over the town after he ate his stew. Yes, this was the place they'd stay. He talked to a number of the men, and they were all in agreement that the Indian menace was a thing of the past. According to them, they had killed so many Apache that they doubted there were enough left to mount a decent war party.
What do you think, honey? Could you be happy here?
Ecstatically.
Then here's where we'll stay.
Blake began to make plans for his church. After what seemed like an eternity, Jason finally opened his eyes and found himself on a cot in one of his cells with Jenny standing at his side.
Well, finally gonna spend some time with us, are you? And don't try to tell me you're going to go back to sleep, mister. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. You've been sleeping forever.
What?
You heard me. 4 in the morning, you lazy thing.
Jason tried to sit up, but he'd forgotten the knife wound in his shoulder and pushed up with the wrong hand, and a stabbing pain went through his shoulder and down his arm.
Ah, crap.
Be careful of that side. Dr. Morelli said that wound of yours might reopen if you got too rough with it.
Jenny smoothed the blanket and sat back down beside his cot. He didn't remember being brought to the jail. He wondered if it was because his house was still full of other people. He wondered if Matt McDonald had left town, and if he'd made a scene with Jenny.
Matt gone?
Yes, the son of a... Well, you know what. He left without even trying to find me. Or his own sister, for goodness sake.
How's Megan?
Oh, she's gonna be fine. And Morelli says that scar won't show at all.
I don't care about the scar.
I know it wouldn't mean anything to you, but Megan's a girl. Things like that are important. Oh, you know what I mean. Honestly, Jason, sometimes you can be such a stinker.
Me? I think you're the one who's a... Never mind. I'm a gentleman.
Are you saying that I'm no lady?
You said it, not me.
And then it occurred to Jason that yes, this time he really could be all right. The town's Indian problem was solved, wasn't it? Ward would make as good a sheriff as he had a deputy once he got used to the idea. His sister Jenny had at last made a clean break with Matt McDonald. The divorce would be fast and efficient. And he'd practically arranged a match for her with Ward. He could leave. He could really, finally, leave.
Of course, you'll have to be careful with that shoulder for a bit. Dr. Morelli said you very nearly lost all use of that arm. And then there's the Mortons. They were completely burnt out, you know. Salmon Kendall and somebody else rode up there this afternoon. He said to tell you that they left the livestock where they found it and just hauled hay and feed out to them. But they brought the dog back to town. That means our house, Jason. Ward says they want to go home, but he told them you had to give them permission to leave town, plus which they don't have a home to go to.
Oh, crud.
And a small train of new people pulled in today. Looks like they're going to stay, too, at least some of them. We've got a new reverend, the Reverend Blake, and he drinks beer. That's what Ward says, anyway. I met his wife, Laura. She's really nice.
A new reverend?
And then there's poor Megan. The poor thing's concerned that her misfortune will leave her disfigured and therefore not good enough for you and...
Stop.
What?
Stop. You win. The town wins. It always does, doesn't it?
What are you talking about?
Nothing. Go away, Jenny.
But Jason...
Not tonight, okay? Let me go back to sleep and we'll talk later. In the real morning, when the sun's up, for instance.
All right, then. Good night, Jason. Sleep tight.
Oh, crud.